When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Victoria Lupashku, one of the hosts for the New Books Network. Today, we are here with Dr. Tana Jean Welch, Associate Professor of Medical Humanities at the Florida State University College of Medicine. Hello, Dr. Welch, and welcome to our channel.
Hello. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for agreeing to talk to us about your new book, Advancing Medical Posthumanism Through 21st Century American Poetry, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 2024. And, you know, as it's a little bit of a tradition here, I want to start today's podcast by getting to know you better and your work. So I was wondering whether you could tell us how you came to this project, what got you interested in poetry, its connection to medicine, posthumanism, and ethics.
Okay. Well, it really is a path that was carved out for me over time, maybe a couple of decades. So it wasn't something I just thought, oh, I'm going to do this. I think things happen to people that way. The poetry was always there. I've been writing poems for most of my adult life. My second collection of poems actually came out a month before this book. So I've been busy with both things. And I see writing poetry as a process of discovery and exploration and explanation. A poem strives to say something that can't be said any other way. So I got my MFA in poetry, and then I wanted to expand my knowledge of poetry. So I still very much just about poetry. So I set out to get a PhD in literature, specifically American poetry. And so once you get to the dissertation phase, you have to have something to write about. So I was exploring possible topics, and I came across an article written by one of my professors. It was a very short article, but it was about post-human ramifications of a pharmacological cure to PTSD. And I hadn't heard of post-humanism before. So I read the article, and then I was like, I need to know more about this. So I read everything I could. I fell in love with Donna Haraway and Rosie Bradotti. I'm not sure if that's how you pronounce her last name, actually.
I'm not sure I can help there, but...
and then I started getting into what I call posthumanism sister theory, which is new materialism. And these philosophies were the first theoretical philosophical standpoints that made absolute sense to me on a practical level. Because in the literary field, you study lots of theories and post-structuralism and all that, it didn't really seem like it was something that could do much action in the real world, but this did feel like it could, that we could absolutely use this to improve and make better, hence the ethical component of my book. So I wrote my dissertation on post-human ethics in contemporary American poetry, and then I was done with that. I got a job after I graduated at the College of Medicine at Florida State, but I was hired as creative writing faculty. So I've been there since then, but I've kind of immersed myself in medical humanities, in what you need to know, the discourse of medical education and medicine. And then it just seemed like applying post-humanism to medical humanism made sense. It helped me narrow down the focus and find a less nebulous application of posthumanism. So again, I see it as a place where real work can be done, not just a theory, if that makes sense. So it's just sort of this path that like just found me. I think of it as that.
Amazing. And it's very important, and I think it is to a lot of us, the connection between, you know, what can be applicable, what can go outside of, you know, the realm of our dissertations or books or articles that we write, So I think that is one of the important draws, right, in the work. We'll get into the book and chapter one, right? Poems are bodies that remind us we have bodies. Poetry, Medical Posthumanism, and Ethical Practice posits that, quote, the health of the individuals is always to focus on the health of the global material and discursive environment and vice versa, end of quote. So from this and also from another quote stating that utilizing ethics as a guide for action, advancing medical posthumanism through 21st century American poetry argues that contemporary poetry provides a valuable analytical framework for applying posthumanist thinking to the to medicine and healthcare, end of quote. So from this, I was very curious to hear more about the posthumanist approach to or in medicine and about the role that poetry plays here. So it's a little bit of a redo of my first question, but with more details. And, you know, another question I had was, how does this approach enhance our understanding of our own bodies in the world as nodes in multiple networks?
Okay. I think it would be useful to just sort of start out for people who aren't familiar what is meant by the term posthumanism.
Absolutely.
Because sometimes there's competing ideas about what it is. But for this project, I'm utilizing the posthumanism that challenges liberal humanism's mind-body duality, the idea that the mind is separate from the body. So posthumanism takes that and says, no, it is not separate. Furthermore, we do not have complete mastery and control over our bodies. There's lots of other factors at play. Posthumanism also acknowledges that first and foremost, we are embodied beings. Our subjectivity and who we are is always connected to our relations with others, other bodies, other forms of discourse, you name it. And another important aspect for this project and posthumanism is the idea that our body, the boundary of our bodies, is permeable. So we're constantly becoming something else. And there's this emphasis on bodily entanglement. Again, emphasis on being constantly in process. We're not like a fixed being. We can always become something more, and we do become something more and different. So fundamentally, think of it as there's no single way to be human. And modern medicine, in my view, is dependent on our posthumanness, the permeability of our bodies, our ability to become something else. All of that is how pharmaceuticals work, prosthetics, things like pacemakers. So essentially, modern medicine depends on this. Another aspect just to consider before I go into how posthumanism helps medicine is the idea that health and illness are not properties of the individual body, but they're qualities that arise from interactions and relationships. So you can't really single out the individual for being at fault for an illness they have. So if we want to apply these to a little bit more to medicine, I think that posthumanism's emphasis on entanglement and embodiment and constant becoming helps us challenge a host of binaries that are harmful. I already mentioned the separation of mind and body, but then the idea of a person being whole, a healthy person is whole and a sick person is fractured or incomplete. The very binary of ill and healthy is false because we're always in constant states of flux. Nature and culture, autonomy and dependence. So these divides are dangerous because they're artificial, for one thing, and because having this either or logic closes down possibilities and limits paths toward positive becomings. And so for me, posthumanism is all about embracing possibilities, being open to different ways of being, positive ways of being. And the other thing this connects to is promoting equity and equality in healthcare through rethinking who and what matters. Because if we're more open, then we can see our kinship to all people and all things. And finally, I think posthumanism helps us become more accepting of death and the limitations of medicine, while fostering kinship through our shared vulnerability. So it's about openness to alterity, change, and community, and the need to do things differently. And I think that medicine can play a big role in like shifting the way we view our existence. The second part of your question was the role poetry plays. And I kind of spoke about it a tiny bit in my first answer, but poetry offers illustrations of post-humanism in action just by the essence of its form and how we define poetry. Poetry uses blank space. It can use collage, fragmented language. There's a lot of ambiguity sometimes. So I think all of those things help it echo our embodied experience. The meaning of a poem, just like the meaning of a body, can shift from reader to reader or from day to day. So the boundaries of a poem, just like our bodies, are mutable and permeable. And poetry, in its plight to say what cannot be said, and its very purpose to express the ineffable, always and more evidently embodies these characteristics. Even the most traditional poems exhibit some degree of dynamism and ambiguity. And so this, to me, means poetry is extremely pliable to express new ways of living and openness. And I don't know if I answered your question about our understanding of our own bodies, but I think it does that in the content and form.
Absolutely.
The poems in the book, they sort of illustrate this again and again.
For sure. And, as we go through the chapters, I'm sure there'll be, concrete examples to show this, right? And to also encourage our readers to, our listeners to become readers, right? To get the book and see more examples. Speaking of that, chapter 2 provides the first main example. And it's entitled Entangled Species, Entangled Health, The Inclusive Poetics of Juliana Spahr. And the chapter shows how individual bodies are not characterized, as you said, through the state of being healthy or ill, but are intertwined in relationships alongside with bodies, becoming a communal, well, having this communal becoming, to put it differently. So, I was wondering about how these relationships emphasize or allow us to think more clearly about kinship. From kinship to this other step forward, how can we think more clearly about health equity? Mm-hmm. And specifically because Juliana Spahr's poetry is beautifully intriguing in the ways in which she uses language to explore this interconnectedness.
Mm-hmm. Her poetry is beautifully intriguing. I like that phrase. I think it captures her work well. And about kinship and health equity, I think they go hand in hand. Many health equity scholars, such as Kamara Jones, have written about to achieve health equity, we need a broader view of community and citizenship, a rethinking of who and what matters. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of what this chapter is utilizing. Because human health is impacted by not just humans, but non-human agents as well, our sense of community and kinship should be expanded to include not only all humans, but also beyond the human. And throughout the book, I think I utilize this Rosie Bradotti quote. Mm-hmm. She says, "We are all in this together, but we are not one in the same." And I kind of repeat that in places throughout the book, the idea that we are all, and the all means not just human, but everybody and everything. The quote is used to emphasize that we share the same planetary home, and as such, we're all subject to a myriad of relational effects. But at the same time, the idea that we are not one and the same emphasizes the need to view ourselves as a more heterogeneous collective, to eliminate Eurocentric ideas about who and what matters, which bodies are important and which do not have value. And I think that's very important for achieving health equity, especially global health equity. And so Spahr, her poetry employs various techniques to illustrate our interconnectedness and our communal kinship, while at the same time, she avoids reduction of others into the same. So I'd like to read one example from her book. It's from the poem, "Some of We in the Land That Was Never Ours." I'll just read the first few lines. "We are all, we of all the small ones are. we are all. We of all the small ones are. We are in this world. We are in this world. We are together. We are together. And some of we are eating grapes. Some of we are all eating grapes. Some of we are all eating. We are all in this world today. Some of we are eating grapes today in this world. And some of we let ourselves eat grapes. In the eating of grapes, we of all the small ones are what eat grapes. In the world of grapes, eating grapes, we of all the small ones are what eats. And some of we are all together in the grapes. We of all the small ones are today in this world by eating grapes. And then the poem goes on for several pages and it takes turns and things. But I think just those opening lines represent the repetition that she creates. This repetition creates an overlap between entities. And so the poem has grapes and humans and sparrows and wine, things that are all, she demonstrates how they're interrelated. So she's tying us together while also maintaining our variability. Because some of us eat grapes, some of us are grapes. That's a reductive example, but hopefully it makes sense. And then I want to do another example of hers, just how her technique illustrates this kinship. Another poem that I discuss in the book is Unnamed Dragonfly Species. It's a 19-page prose poem where Spar weaves together things like melting glaciers, global warming, endangered species, human violence, and human vulnerability. She weaves it all to show, again, how we're all connected in some way to these species, ecosystems, and events. And this entanglement of species is metaphorically demonstrated through her splicing of the state of New York's list of endangered species into the poem. After each sentence, she just puts a name of an endangered species and then goes on to the next sentence. And it creates a really cool effect. And I'm just going to read a sample from that. Hey, golden winged, and I'm just pulling right from the middle of the poem. Golden winged warbler. At various moments, they joined each other and many others in thinking about Pan Am Flight 103 that had exploded over Lockerbie, Scotland. Grasshopper sparrow. And then again, they all noticed on the same day when the U.S. shot down Iran Air Flight 655, supposedly by accident, in the Persian Gulf. Gravel chub. And several of them did not go to the beach in 1988 because the beach near them was in New Jersey. And that year, beaches in New Jersey were closed because of medical waste coming ashore. Gray petaltail. So it just goes on and on with these sorts of examples. And it creates an interesting effect because I think at first they're distracting, but then as humans are wont to do, we can keep reading and we start to sort of skip over the species names. And that also reminds us that that's what we do. We try to block out or forget or ignore these problems that maybe we've created. And so I think it's a really cool effect that she has created with that poem. Mm-hmm.
For sure. And it's also, it underlines, it brings the details into the conversation because I think we all have heard and we used it in our other conversations, this idea of endangered species and, the fauna and the flora are diminishing and, but we never actually know, like, what's the name, who is disappearing, right?
Yeah.
We know about the polar bears, but at least to me, that's the very much extent of,
right. No, absolutely. I'd hadn't even heard of most of those species before.
Yeah, so I think it's a very good way to bring attention, also to demonstrate how we skip over, but also right to sit with the issue and reteach us to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's I definitely ordered Juliana Spar's book.
Oh, good.
I'm looking forward to the semester ending so that I can read in more peace,
Yes, yes. Oh, that's exciting to hear.
It is, yeah. And but you know, we'll put that conversation aside for a bit, because I want to ask you about Claudia Rankine's poetry that you explore in chapter 3, which is entitled "Health Inequity, Structural Racism, and the Transcorporeal Ethics of Claudia Rankine's Investigative Poetics." And the chapter continues the conversation on health equity and underlines the myriad ways in which racism propagates through society, especially through media. And here I would love to hear more about Rankine's poetry and her proposal to see the human as just one small part of an intricate set of networks.
Okay. I think in a lot of ways she's doing something similar to Spar, but just with a different emphasis. So Spar's poetry is geared more heavily toward ecology and our kinship with the natural environment. And Rankine's focus is on our interconnectedness with media, capitalism, more of a semiotic nature, American culture in general, and how these entities shape our health. In all three of her recent books, she uses investigative technique, which is also known as documentary poetics, to show not only the harmful and unhealthful effects of racism on Black lives specifically, but also in the process, she shows the body's position as part of these intricate networks, as you phrased it, in general. And so I think I'll explain investigative poetics a little bit for those who aren't familiar. Mm-hmm. Investigative poetry, it's part documentary, part imagination, and it incorporates a variety of data and reportage into the poem. It can include testimonials, interviews, photographs, facts and figures. Rankine includes a lot of quotes from other writers. She weaves that in. And this is done to explore the historical and political conditions of our culture. Rankine in an interview has even said that the form allows her to acknowledge the total experience of being. And I read that phrase as being an acknowledgement of our post-humanity and our interconnectedness and kinship with others. Like, that total experience of being has to include everything that shapes who we are. And she uses this to highlight how this constant barrage of media specifically shapes our perspective of self and others, and shows how much power it has on us and that we should try to question that. So one example, I won't read the poem, but I'll sort of describe it. She has a poem in Don't Let Me Be Lonely that it links police violence against unarmed Blacks via news photographs and image steals from the news with statistical information on prescription drug use and liver damage. And she includes some examples that illustrate the post 9/11 cultural climate in America. And that's anything from Bruce Springsteen's music at the time to press reports with President George W. Bush. And she just puts the items all together. She doesn't tell us why. She's not didactic. She doesn't tell us why she's putting these certain things together, but she leaves it to us to investigate further and make the connections on her presented evidence. In the chapter, I write about how she leaves a lot of blank space in the book, and I take that space to be the place where we're supposed to stop and think about what she's given us. And each poem contains different types of documentary evidence. One poem has a list of all the drug companies that protested the idea, I'm not phrasing it very well right now, but the idea to lower the price of HIV medications for Africa. That's a little bit more to that, but she has this list of the drug companies. And all of this evidence serves to link racism, a racism that's perpetuated by a confluence of culture, politics, capitalism, and media, linking that to poor mental health and increased chronic health conditions. And so I think it shows a lot of what we need to pay attention to if we're wanting to get health equity again, just like Spar.
Mm-hmm. And it opens, right? It opens the horizon of issues that come into our view. And that, again, we might have heard about before, or we just have some sort of a vague idea, but we haven't sat with them. For long, and I think she provides, as you say, in those blank spaces, she provides both the impetus, but also, you know, the urgency of sitting with these things and thinking and having a position towards them.
Yes, and thinking, that thinking, and I like that she doesn't just tell us what to think. I mean, we know that whole adage, show, don't tell, and then it's going to stick with the reader longer. But it's actually making us do the mental work, and I think that's really important so that it does stick with us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, it makes for amazing teaching material as well.
Yes.
And, you know, speaking of teaching and language in general, we get to chapter 4, entitled Language Matter Movement, Global Health Inequity and the Anti-Capitalist Poetics of Kathy Park Honk. And here we focus on the ways in which language and material locations shape each other in a context defined by imperialist capitalism and consequent exploitation and migration. Kathy Park Hong proposes a model of community building that takes into account post-human affirmative ethics. You know, and my question is very similar to the other chapters in saying, you know, how does her poetry achieve this? And how can we imagine, you know, different types of connections through it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so she does do something a little different than Rankine and Spar. So I think this, it's good to turn to a different mode of writing. Specifically, I look at her book, Dance, Dance, Revolution. And in that book, she proposes a different model of community building through her creation of Desert Creole. So it's a sort of a new language or dialect. Desert Creole is a mashup of standard and slang words from Middle English, Spanish, French, and many other languages. And almost every poem in the book is written in this invented language. And it scares some readers away at first, but I believe once you start reading it, then you just get it and you get used to the dialect. Mm-hmm. And I think that's also an important part of what she's doing, the idea that she's forcing us to get used to something different and not just shut down when we're faced with it. But the book is set in Desert with a capital D. It's a global resort city, and the migrant workers and natives are the ones who speak Desert Creole. So in that sense, Desert Creole is not in that sense, but Desert Creole is the metaphor for how we are constantly shaped and remade through our contact with all others, because the language exists because people from all over the world came to this place to work. And then how all material and embodied others were shaped by that, as well as our contact with language and media. And using that language and the setting itself and the story with the migrant workers, she illustrates how community can be formed not by sameness or common interests, but by our variations. So in the chapter, I discussed the language Desert Creole as a form of plurilingualism. Plurilingualism is a fluid and variable form of language practice in which different languages are used in a single system. And mastery of the individual languages is not necessary to communicate. With plurilingual language barriers do not shut one out of a community, but it also doesn't mean forsaking one community for another. And I think that whole idea is very post-human to me. Plurilingualism allows members of various language groups to interact, which results in unity or a continuity of affiliations. As linguists have noted of South Asian plurilingualism, unlike other communities where individual differences have to be sacrificed for group identity, South Asian communities preserve their group differences while also developing an overarching community identity with other groups. And so again, I'm going to quote Brodody, we are all in this together, but we are not one in the same. So I think plurilingualism celebrates that idea again and with a different example. The people in the community are not the same. They don't speak the same. Their first language isn't the same, but they are still in it together. And the book, this idea of Desert Creole also helps with the idea that there's not one language to master. And I'm thinking of English language as the language that's expected, and that a lot of times people judge other people who can't speak the English, or, you know, the idea of immigrants in our own country. Some people say, go back to where you came from if you're not speaking proper English. And so I like that it fights against that notion. There's not one right way to speak. And I even think like accepting what's considered improper grammar is fine. We know what the person is saying just because they didn't say it exactly how the rules dictate. So I think plurilingualism and Desert Creole are perfectly posthuman in their embrace of this kind of becoming and evolving with language. And it shows there's many ways and possibilities for existence. It's that ongoing dance of becoming, which is why the title of the book, Dance, Dance, Revolution, is also so perfect for this project.
It is. And, you know, when you think about Dance, Dance, Revolution and the machines, right, that kind of introduced the, well, I'm not sure if we can call them consoles, but, you know, and how they were created, imported, and then modified, and, you know, re-exported and re-imported, and all of this exchange between North America and, you know, Asia, and then, you know, kind of going into Europe. So only like that example is so productive in thinking of these connections and these networks and, you know, unequal exchanges as well that, you know, imperialist capitalism has created. And, you know, it kind of goes to what you're saying about English and the expectation that English should be known, should be used to a certain standard. And then, you know, I'm thinking about older groups of population that do not speak English or speak it with a certain inflection, and how they disappear from, you know, from view because of that.
Right.
Yeah.
I really love what you said about the actual video game machine. I hadn't thought about that, but it is another good example.
I find it fascinating. And, you know, there's still like in some dorms in different universities in the United States, you can still find like one. And, you know, sometimes they're cues.
They've all got to be somewhere. That's so fascinating.
Yeah, and you know, from that, we go to explore another poet, Brian Thayer, in chapter 5, entitled "Shared Suffering and Chronic Vulnerability in the Poetry of Brian Thayer." And this chapter brings to the fore an important conversation centering vulnerability as an important intersubjective, transformational, and continuous state whose acknowledgement from a post-humanist perspective can change the extant understanding of both medicine and death. Can we hear more about Thayer's poetry and its thinking of vulnerability?
So all of his poetry, his books, in my mind, recognize our vulnerability. And I'm not looking at vulnerability as a negative thing. I'm looking at it as more of a positive recognition that we are open and changeable. So our susceptibility to the co-shaping touch of others, whether it's harmful, beneficial, or both. So Thayer recognizes all of that. And two of his books, he composed while walking. So he's out in the world, in fields, cities, refineries, watersheds. And he's recording recording with his pen, I guess, the process of becoming with non-human others in real time. So that's what two of his books do. But my chapter focuses on the book he wrote when he was too sick to walk. It's called The Empty Form Goes All the Way to Heaven. And the poems in this book chronicle his journey as someone living with chronic pain from an unknown chronic illness and his discovery that the true survival depends on embracing the body's vulnerability, on giving up the idea of complete control inherent in liberal humanism, that quest for control and mastery of the body. The book Empty Form speaks to the value of living in recognition of our embodied openness, our embodied vulnerability, and Thayer's form plays a huge role in this. He writes, the poems in this book are written in, I'll call them grids. It's going to be hard to explain orally without the visual picture, but each poem consists of a number of rectangular or square blocks of text, and they're arranged in a grid-like fashion on the page and can be, and they actually do work if you read them. You can read them all across right to left, or you can start and read up and down and it works both ways. The meaning shifts a little bit, but it's very fascinating that he was able to do this. So you can read it in multiple ways, and because of that, the book itself is asking us to be open to uncertainty, to not knowing which order to read the lines, not knowing if we've chosen the right direction. So the form itself invites readers to learn from a situation that is unfamiliar and therefore uncomfortable. And in an interview, Tyr even says that he partly wanted the reader to know what it feels like to not know, because he lived so many years of his life not knowing what was going on with his body. Mm-hmm. And it's this vulnerability, which could be defined as the state of openness to the unknown and openness to be changed by someone else's suffering, that I think medicine should embrace. The first section of the book reveals how frustrating the unknown can be for patients, not just for physicians, because I think part of Tyr's agenda and my own would be to discover how physicians feel in the face of the unknown and how it goes so much against their training. Like, they want to be able to solve or fix everything. Mm-hmm. The poems convey this frustration vividly. Tyr writes, "Illness is mostly the mystery of why one window opens slowly, why one window remains locked." And he writes, "Ill, I attempt a long time to experience diagnosis." And he has his struggle with the unknown, because no one is actually able to give him a diagnosis for many years. This struggle comes partly from the way Western medicine approaches the body as a problem to be solved, like I said. Medicine casts the sick person as broken, in need of repair, so the patient too feels there must be an immediate solution. And when one fails to present itself, the patient is made to feel as though it's their fault for having an abnormal body. So that goes back to the sort of dangerous binaries of medicine: broken, fixed, whole, fragmented, normal, abnormal. And a lot of times medicine presents it, the idea that, or sort of conveys the act that, the idea that it's better for the patient to be wrong than the physician. Mm-hmm. So both Tyr as patient and as physicians needed to become comfortable with embracing the unknown and comfortable with vulnerability. So the book sort of follows this journey. The first section is like the idea of the uncomfort of the unknown. And by the end of the book, he's come to accept his vulnerability and that he should embrace the unknown when he has to. I think it's a really good book for this.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think it joins the conversation also on, patients with autoimmune diseases or allergies that cannot be diagnosed per se. And, talking about this and talking about, through the reading practice and offering that experience of the unknown on the page, I think it definitely opens up the conversation about these instances where both physician and patient and their support network are just faced with this, almost ontological question of, not finding something, right?
Right. I really like the phrase opening up the conversation. I think that's what all these books have the power to do. Mm-hmm. And I just love thinking of it that way.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so too. And I think that it's the case with the next two examples from chapter 6, Affirmative Medicine, the Queer Figurations of Sam Fox and Franny Choi, that propose ways of opening up medicine to different modalities of being and living. And it's really, and we've been, as human beings, we've been dealing with this for a long time, the binary type of thinking. Mm-hmm. And they propose a different way. And I was wondering about how can we dissolve the binary thinking and achieve better medicine for all?
Mm-hmm. So I think dissolving the binary thinking is a step toward achieving better medicine. And I think part of this will come from what you've already said, opening up conversations, from promoting a cultural understanding of the reality of our physical existence, that we are part of an assemblage, we're always existing in knotted relations with others. And I think the more we can get people to see that, the better. Assemblages are always in process in their constant state of becoming, and they vary from person to person, and they vary from space, place, and time. And they're always contingent on the relations that exist. So this constant movement, I see it as, if we can see ourselves as constantly moving or constantly in process, then the next logical step would be to see that rigid binaries are illusions. I don't know if that was true for everybody, but that's sort of what I hope. And getting rid of the rigid binaries expands possibilities for connecting bodies with health-producing assemblages. So I think it's all linked together. So to reiterate, this dynamic nature of existence means it can be positive. Things can be different. We can act in ways that create health-producing assemblages over health-diminishing assemblages. So I think it's important to note, because a lot of times I feel like when I'm talking or in this book, I'm emphasizing that there is a lack of control, and that is not true. It's just that we don't have complete control. We can make choices that are more positive producing. And that's what affirmative ethics is. Mm-hmm. And so I think all of the poets in the book are working toward this dissolution of binary thinking in their demonstration of interconnectedness. But in this chapter, I talk specifically about the use of queer figurations as an aid toward the dissolution of binaries. Like humans understand things a lot better if they're put into metaphors or figurations. So Franny Choi uses the cyborg in her book, and Sam Sachs uses the monster. And so the poems have a persona that take on the mantle of cyborg or monster. And I add queer as a descriptor for these figurations to further emphasize the non-normative spirit of both. Queer is mobile, dynamic, at odds with any defined expectation of being. And monsters and cyborgs make perfect queer figurations because they defy this classification. So they're defying being put in an either-or binary, for example. The monster is a monster because there's nowhere else to put it. And, mm-hmm. and no two monsters are the same. They're singular. So again, you have that idea of we're all in this together, but we're not the same. And cyborgs also serve as excellent signposts because they delight in confusing boundaries between human, animal, and machine. So I think that's how that's working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, I mean, Sam Sachs and Franny Choi, right, offer very beautiful, right, a text to work with. And you know, I would ask for an example, but you know, you can totally say no and like let the.
I tried to find one that would be like that was mm-hmm. be exemplary enough in its smallness. Mm-hmm. I guess I could. I think I can read. I did highlight a section in case it was necessary. It's not really the poem, but it's an example with a line from a poem. So Choi has a series of poems in the book under the subtitle Turing Test. And so we know the Turing Test is it's a famous test Alan Turing made to sort of see if humans can tell the difference between the computer and the human. Mm-hmm. So she kind of develops that in her book. Her cyborg is asked questions and she answers them with the poems are the answers to the questions. And she, what I think that Choi does really well is her cyborg is embodied. It has a subjectivity. It doesn't matter if it's part metal or part human or not. It still is an embodied being with subjectivity, and she demonstrates that with the poems. She repeatedly equates the material body with subjectivity and consciousness. Mm. Let's see if we can get an example here. Okay, so in one of the Turing tests, the question is, how do we know you are you and not someone else? And she says, they said a word and touched me. That's how I learned. Anywhere it doesn't hurt, that's where I end. Any face, strange, a stranger, but they tore that girl's throat and bad sounds left me. They made her dance and my feet were sore in the morning. So reading it out loud doesn't fully capture it because she uses slashes in the poem to give it more of that, make it feel more like it's coming from a computer. But her response, and this is, it's in other places too, she sort of highlights embodiment and material vulnerability. But her response basically is saying, I know that I'm me because I hurt. And places where it stops hurting, that's not me. Again, and I'll just give another section just because I really like these poems. The question asked is, how can we know that these are not simply simulated emotions? And again, the response leans on material vulnerability. The answer to that question was, the nurse missed my vein and dug for it. It was a white light, a tin flame in the forearm, fluorescent, sick vinyl. What else can I say? I opened, I cried, and the needle drank. So again, the answer to that you're simulated is, but I have this body and it hurts. It can be in pain. So I think illustrating that with the cyborg is really important.
For sure, for sure. And yeah, it opens up the right, this tension, right, with between cyborg and, you know, the descriptor, as you said, queer, and, you know, just having this these poems to refer to, it's a very important step in this, you know, kind of effacing the binary thinking, or starting at least. I'm not sure if we completely done away with it, but at least
that might be impossible out of the nature of how our brains work. I think I still like to think that over time the brains evolve, and maybe one day, but
yeah,
that's not to say there's not a place for that kind of thinking. I just don't think it's good for a field like medicine, or a place where you're trying to help others.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And I think that from that, we can go into the CODA, affirmative ethics entangled knowing, because it brings everything together. And, you know, it does suggest an almost material possibility of becoming together. Also suggests a plurivalent care and shared time and space between non-humans and humans. And, you know, here, just to wrap everything up, I was wondering about the ways in which entangled knowing both advances and sustains a post-humanist approach in medicine and in affirmative ethics.
Okay, so in this CODA, I borrow ideas from an article in a nursing journal. In nursing, emancipatory knowing is defined as the ability to recognize social and political problems of injustice or inequity, to realize that things could be different, and to identify or participate in social or political change to improve people's lives. So that's emancipatory knowing. And this article that I borrow from proposes that posthumanism should be applied to emancipatory knowing. And with that, you can maximize the knowledge. You would weave in all forms of knowledge together, not just the empirical form of knowledge that drives evidence-based medicine. Because an over-reliance on empirical evidence sort of erases the entirety of human experience. And post-human concepts of entanglement and embeddedness tell us that all patterns of knowing are required for meaningful healthcare, for affirmative ethics. So while we are all continuous beings in process, transformed and transforming with and by others, thinking of that, I like, there's a quote by Donna Haraway. It's kind of the idea that the story is never entirely our own. It matters what matters we use to think other matters with, what stories make worlds, what worlds make stories. So it matters that we have other kinds of knowledge, not just the limited, far Eurocentric white male view, for example. We're expanding the reach, expanding the types of knowledge we have and who we get that from. And so we have more of an expansive point of view. And these patterns of knowing include indigenous knowledge, post-human methodologies. It could be art-based knowledge. And the poets discussed in this book offer these different ways of knowing and thinking through their art. And so thus they're contributing to a fuller, more complex webs of knowledge. And that's kind of what I mean by entangled knowing and how it can advance the post-humanist approach and affirmative ethics, is because it's giving us more and more possibilities, more things to choose from. And that's what I want the book to mostly be about, expansion and cultivating openness to different ways of knowing and being. I think a lot of our current political problems are connected to the idea that things need to be a certain way and stay a certain way.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, the underlying idea of, you know, prescriptions and set protocols for medicine. And you know, I'm not debating the surgical field, and, you know, I understand protocols need to exist, but also, you know, knowing about your own body, right? And the conversation between, you know, patients and physicians about symptoms and about feelings, right? Like, it feels bad, it feels good, right? So the type of knowledge that is stationary in a way that I think the book is trying to encourage to open up and to be more dynamic and accepting of things that are not evidence-based.
Right. And hunting out that knowledge, hunting out the patient's knowledge of their own experience. I mean, that, of course, is taught, and at least is taught at the medical school I work at. But I think we always can emphasize that more, that it's not just what the physician knows.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And yeah, and, you know, there are more and more studies coming out in prestigious journals, right, science journals, giving more space to these, you know, like the off symptom or the off sign, or, you know, just trying to give credibility to different types of knowing that can be very helpful and opens up avenues of research that is so important, for example, in Parkinson's or, you know, in Alzheimer's sometimes. Yeah, but, you know, that can be a very long conversation over this. and we have already taken a lot of your time. So I was wondering whether you would tell us more about what your current projects are.
So as I said, I just had a poetry book come out and this book come out. So I haven't started a project, but I have ideas for how I'm going to go forward. And with your first question, I talked about how my discovery of post-humanism was exciting for me because I wanted to have a theory that could be actually applied in real time. But the book itself doesn't do that. It introduces the poems that can help us understand the ideas, but doesn't tell us how to put it into practice necessarily. And in the coda, I kind of ask the question, how can we put this into practice? And I say maybe a medical school course or continuing medical education session dedicated to one of these books, or a hospitalist reading group, or a reading group that includes patients. I want some solid ideas. So what I'd like to do next is a book that gives solid ideas, like you can do this with these people to create this effect. And in the spirit of entangled knowing, it should be an edited anthology. So I'm going to be having call for papers or call for submissions and try to find people who are, in a sense, practicing post-human medicine, I guess. I don't know. It's all very new and vague right now, but I'm hoping that I can get some more practical approaches to this, if that makes sense.
Of course, it does. It makes a lot of sense. And I think the energy and, you know, the curiosity and the desire is there, you know, from your voice. And I'm absolutely looking forward to the call for papers and, you know, possible collaborations, or, you know, just to see the anthology coming out and having you back on New Books Network, you know.
Yeah, no, that would be cool. Yes, that's, I am excited to see if, like, that would be the next step for this, this project here.
Looking forward to it. And, you know, I thank you very much for talking to us today. And I hope the book will get the traction that it deserves and it needs.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Thank you.